Hey. Can I introduce the next speaker? If you haven't met Tommy Ice, you really haven't lived. He's a Texan back home where he really belongs, and he fits into the crowd here. And the only difference between Tommy and I is our mothers both told us if you stood up a lot, you would grow tall. Well, his mother told the truth. But my mother's in heaven, and she started out at 5 feet even. And she was one of the best soul winners I ever met. And I thank God for that kind of heritage. And Tommy, you've invested your life in Bible prophecy, teaching the Word of God, and contending for the faith. These are exciting times, and the church and the world needs the message that we have to preach, that Jesus is coming, and the only way to plan for the future is to know Him.
Right. Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much. Appreciate your contribution for getting... For getting this organization going 23-something years ago when we met. And my mother is something that his mother's not, because my mother is a woman who used to be a man. And I bet your mother always was a woman. And then when she married my dad, her last name was changed from Man to Ice. And... when I was born, I'm Iceman, so. And they said a chip off the old block. All of those wonderful things. But I'm going to start off with the first session here. A proposed approach to the application of Bible prophecy to current events. And I'm probably going to make about two-thirds of you mad. Especially some of you sitting on the front row here. But I want to present what I think is a sound approach to, first of all, understanding Bible prophecy, and secondly, to applying it to the events that are going on today. Because for 2,000 years of church history, people have... thought they're living in the last days. I think that's a healthy belief personally, and I do believe that Bible prophecy can be applied to today, but I think there's right ways and wrong ways, and part of it has to do with proper interpretation of passages and various assumptions and presuppositions along with various application. So I'm kind of starting off the conference you know, in this what could be a bad way for many of you, but hopefully it is something that will help us. And you can see from the graphic here on this first slide that this is an old chart in our chart book that we stole from Clarence Larkin. Of course, we didn't put the gap theory in or anything like that, but nevertheless, I think it well illustrates the approach that the Bible gives to Bible prophecy, and that is that God first lays down His plan for history and for the nation of Israel. And so all the prophecies in the Old Testament deal with Israel and their plan and how they relate to the world as a whole. And this is depicted in this graphic as being mountaintops. In other words, that's what the prophet saw, things relating to Israel. And then you have things that were always part of God's plan, and I hate it when I hear people say dispensationalists believe that God had plan A with Israel and He failed, and then He came in with plan B, the church. That's not at all. I've never heard a dispensationalist actually teach that. I've always heard critics of dispensationalism say that that's what we believe. That's not at all what we believe. We believe that God's sovereign plan, as Ephesians chapter 3 points out, has always included the church, but it wasn't revealed until Really, the Apostle Paul. Well, Christ introduces it in the Upper Room Discourse, and then it's expanded upon in the epistles. And so that is the hidden part of God's plan called the church. And so, therefore, things like the rapture and these kind of things are not revealed at all in the Old Testament. They're only in the New Testament. And so God comes in and he lays down, like in the book of Daniel, I think prophecy really starts in the book of Deuteronomy, where he gives an outline of Israel's history. And then he starts expanding upon it in the prophets, etc. And he then shows how the nations relate to him, like in Daniel chapter 2, relates to God's plan for the nations. And then chapter 7 is how Israel fits into that and God's perspective of those beasts, etc., and how they relate to Israel. That's why the United States is not in Bible prophecy specifically. We're obviously with part of the nations and all of that kind of stuff, but we're not directly involved. And so he comes in then with church age truth, because the church age is a temporary phase in God's plan. And why? Because it corresponds with Israel's national rejection of the Messiah. And you see this in the book of Acts being laid out. And I believe on the day of Pentecost, when the church began, they did not understand what was going on instantly. In other words, there was progression there, and God revealed to Peter and the apostles gradually what he was doing with the church. And so you have in Acts chapter 1, they're asking them, are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel? The kingdom is the millennium, of course, that we know of. And it says that he had been teaching them concerning the things of the kingdom during this 40-day period. And so he obviously did not teach them that there's going to be just a spiritual form of the kingdom and no actual physical form. And he obviously taught that this kingdom was going to be for Israel, and they wanted to know when. And that's what's always dominated prophetic studies. When is something going to happen? When is the rapture going to happen? When is the Antichrist arrival going to occur? When is Christ going to return? And he says it's not for you to know the times of the season, which the Father has fixed in his plan. And then you go to chapter 3, where Peter is preaching and teaching, and he says that Christ will be held in the heavens, the Messiah, until the nation of Israel repents. So that's a condition for the second coming, is that Israel has to repent. We find it at the end of Matthew 23 as well, and some other passages. And so the condition for the second coming is the nation of Israel has to be converted. And in a similar way that they rejected Christ in the first century, in a similar way, the nation as a whole is going to accept him, and that will lead to his return. And he says at the end of Matthew 23, you will not see me again. Your house is being left to you desolate, the temple. And you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And that's a messianic greeting that they were to give. And so it's estimated as much as 25-30% of Jewish people in the first century accepted Jesus as Messiah. And that's kind of shocking to a lot of goyim here, Gentiles. But nevertheless, the nation as a whole rejected him. And I believe the tribulation period is going to be a time in which the nations as a whole reject Christ. And you see that in Isaiah chapters 24, 25, 26, 27, Isaiah's apocalypse. Little apocalypse, it's called. And this is what Revelation 3:10 is saying, that the purpose of the tribulation in relation to the Gentiles is to test those who dwell upon the earth. And the earth dwellers are used 11 times in the book of Revelation to refer to people, none of whom become believers. They reject Christ. They all take the mark of the beast. And they are thoroughly tested by the 19 seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments that occur during the tribulation to vindicate that an unbeliever is an unbeliever is an unbeliever, no matter what circumstance you put them into. And therefore, the purpose of the church age is for God to reach the nations through the preaching of the gospel. And we then go on in the progress of the book of Acts as God unveils a little more in the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15, where he talks about the fact that you do not have to convert to Judaism in order to become a believer, which it was the issue that many in the Jerusalem church were wondering about. And so James stands up and says that, don't you know that God first said that we're going to take out from among the people, from among the Gentiles, a people for his name. And therefore, then he will return and rebuild the fallen tabernacle of David. And he's quoting there from Amos 9. But in Amos 9, it says, in the last days, he will rebuild the fallen tabernacle of David. And that's an idiomatic phrase, tabernacle of David, to refer to Israel's, God's plan for Israel. Because David is pictured as someone who's one day going to reign in victory in the millennium, you see. So the tabernacle of David, you know, is referring to the house. This is not some form of worship as people are talking about today. Or it's not an actual building that some have said that has to be rebuilt or anything. It's a dynasty that David and his descendants, much of it will be fulfilled through Christ himself, who is a descendant of David, and Israel will enter into her blessings. In fact, back in Acts 3, he talked about the times of refreshing, a millennial term, and how Christ is held in the heavens until the times of refresh and preventing the times of refreshing from coming in. And so they're learning in the book of Acts that they're transitioning from Israel to the church, but God's not finished with Israel. And so after he takes out from among the Gentiles the people of his name, the ingathering of the church age, and we learn in Romans 11 that it says when the full number of the Gentiles comes in, then the deliverer will come out of Zion. In other words, and all Israel will be saved. And whatever all Israel means, it means those intended to be saved, which leads to the conversion of the nation and therefore to fulfill the conditions in the future for Israel's calling on Messiah to come and rescue them at the second coming. And so, that within that framework, you have the church age that was placed in there as a temporary phase where Jew and Gentile, according to Ephesians 2, are united co-equally in Christ. And that's why God cannot fulfill the promises made to Israel as Israel, dozens of which have never been fulfilled. Basically, to sum those promises up, Israel will be the head over the nations and not the tail, and she'll be exalted, and you cannot have the church on planet Earth and have those promises literally fulfilled for Israel. And so that's why God, Christ, introduced in the upper room discourse for the first time the rapture of the church in John 14, 1 through 3, in order to as he introduces it toward the end of chapter 16, the upper room discourse is 16 through, chapter 13 through 16 of John, followed by the high priestly prayer, chapter 17. And the upper room discourse is a few hours before Christ's death, the night before he died, in which he is transitioning the apostles to become the founders of the church. And he introduces them to church age truth. And church age truth is all he talks about once Judas leaves the room at the end of chapter 13. And one of those doctrines is the doctrine of the rapture of the church. And this is one of the reasons I don't believe it's a few weeks earlier in the Olivet Discourse, because that's relating to Israel and the second coming, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. But nevertheless, the rapture is introduced along with other church age truths, like the indwelling ministry of Christ, like the fact that Christians are going to be persecuted during the church age. By the way, let me get off on a little side
bunny path here, or maybe it's an elephant path, I'm not sure. But today, one of the biggest arguments against pre-tribulationalism is, well, I believe Christians have to suffer. Now, that's something you'd only hear in America. You know, and I always tell folks, if you want to suffer, I suggest you go to Saudi Arabia or someplace like that and yell, Allah's a wimp, or something like that, and see how long you last. Even though English isn't their main language, they would probably figure it out pretty quick. And I'll bet you, you could have some suffering if you need to suffer. Or Sudan would be a good place. You know, go to one of those spots and do that. In other words, America is a blessed nation. And this has been a unique time in which Christians have not had to suffer. God has used us to help spread the gospel and given us freedom, founded, you know, on our Pilgrim and Puritan fathers who came over here to not for religious freedom as much as they wanted to practice their way of doing church, so to speak. They didn't want to have everybody else come over there and practice their way of doing church. By the way, they outlawed Christmas, you know. It was against the law to practice Christmas until about the 1830s. Easter was outlawed as well. You know, those were Catholic holidays, and we can't have that. And they restored a lot of the Old Testament and the Jewish emphasis in Christianity, but the problem was they applied it to the church. The church was the new Israel and things like that. So my point is that the whole church age is a time of suffering and persecution of believers from the world. That's what Jesus is saying in John 15. But the tribulation is a time of God's wrath upon the world, starting immediately with the seal judgments, as summarized at the end of chapter 6. The wrath of the Lamb and the wrath of Him who sits on the throne is what the tribulation is all about. And that God is not going to beat up His bride before He marries her in chapter 19. And therefore, the fact of the matter is that the church age is temporary and it's going to end suddenly and unexpectedly. And that's why three times when Christ introduces church age truth that is expanded upon in the epistles, He introduces the rapture in chapter 14. And He says three times in 13, 14, 15, 16, that there's too much for you to bear, you the apostles, but when He, the Spirit of truth, comes, He will guide you into all things. And later we get the epistles, especially Paul's second and third epistles, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, where he talks right off the bat in his career, if you want to call it that. I don't know what you call it, his ministry. Early on, his second and third epistles were about the church's eschatology, and he teaches the rapture in 1 Thessalonians because it's unique. He introduces it to us. And we learn from Galatians and other places that Paul did not receive the gospel, he says, directly from the apostles in Jerusalem, but he received it in heaven from God when he was caught up, raptured, harpazoed. 2 Corinthians 12, into heaven and received direct revelation about these events so that he could reveal this to the church. And so the church age is a unique temporary time in which we're to preach the gospel to all nations, and Jew and Gentiles are co-equal. That's going to end. Why? Because God has to complete the 70th week of Daniel, which is for Israel. And that's why Israel is going to be the instrument through which He works. And so the church has to be gone. And that's why you have the preacher rapture, to end the temporary church age so that God can, as James said, return and rebuild the fallen tabernacle of David. And that's why much of the evangelism is going to be fulfilled by 144,000 Jewish witnesses, so that Israel will eventually fulfill her calling to be a priestly nation to the nations. She has been used by God to give us the scriptures. Every writer of scripture is Jewish. She has been called to give us the Messiah. And of course, Jesus is Jewish. And she's been called to be a light to the nations. And when you look in, is it Isaiah 42, I think it is, or 62, I can't remember, you have the fact, the statement about Israel is to be a light to the nation, and the context there is eschatological in the future. She will fulfill her calling to be a light to the nations during the tribulation period leading up to her salvation. And so this is basically an outline of what the Bible teaches in these areas. And therefore, since we are in the church age, we are not fulfilling Israel's promises. And God is not, I don't think, working according to the Sabbaths don't apply to the church age, because he suspended his dealings with Israel. And so that gets me into the topic that I want to deal with, and that is that people have all kinds of speculation today about blood moons, aligning of the planets and all. In other words, trying to figure out how God's going to use, for example, naturalistic phenomena rather than supernatural phenomena I call it helping God out. And I like to talk about the shake and bake commercial from back in our days, where you had the little girl, you know, shake and bake, and I hepped, H-E-P-E-D, hepped. They're trying to help God out here by trying to figure out how a meteorite or something like this is going to fulfill some event in the tribulation and all of this kind of stuff. If you read the text, those are actual supernatural events. Just like creation, where God is initiating all of this stuff from heaven. The only non-heavenly, directly initiated things where he uses human agency are the first five seal judgments. And once you get past there to the sixth seal judgment, everything else is coming out of heaven. That's why angels are heavily involved in the events of the tribulation. And so what this does is it creates a period in which Bible prophecy in the church age is not being fulfilled per se. What we have in the church age are just general trends about how the church age is going to be. And you have a transition period to fulfill Israel, to destroy the temple at the end of the beginning of the church age, etc. And then you have the fulfillment of prophetic events, starting with the rapture, which is a prophetic event that will end the church age. And then you have the interval of time of days, weeks, months, or years, probably years, between the end of the church age, the rapture, and the start of the tribulation, in which you will have further preparation for fulfillment of the events that will take place during the 70th week of Daniel. Because I believe that these prophetic events that relate to Israel, when Israel is the instrument through which God is working again, will come into play at that time. Charlie Dyer, who was at our first few pre-trib study group meetings in a book called Issues in Dispensationalism, says the biblical meaning of fulfillment. Before one can determine when a prophecy is fulfilled, first one must know exactly what is being predicted. The meaning of the prophecy must be determined within its original context. And I see people today within our group pulling out prophecies and not paying attention to how that passage is used in its original context. Is it talking about the tribulation? Is it talking about the second coming? Is it talking about the millennium? Is it in the New Testament epistles, basically, talking about things relating to the church age? You see, you have to let the Bible tell you what that passage is related to, then you go out and interact with what's going on today. And Ed Heinzen, this is one of his first prophecy books over 20 years ago, called End Times, the Middle East, and the New World Order. 1991. Boy, I remember when I thought the 90s were, boy. And now here we are in 2014, almost. It is December, isn't it? Yeah, it's December already, and we're about to hit 215. Wow. Okay, but nevertheless, he talks about how there need to be facts that are, these are clearly stated facts of prophetic revelation. Christ will return for his own. He will judge the world. There will be a time of great trouble on the earth at the end of the age. The final conflict will be won by Christ and so on. And these basic facts are clearly stated in Scripture. And see, these are the basic, clear things that we all agree on. And I would add, I'll show you in a moment, something to that. And then he talks about next, people bring in assumptions. And this is where it starts to get a little fuzzy. People say, assume certain things, and often they're not aware of these assumptions that they're making when they pass from interpretation and, you know, clear facts of what the Scripture's saying. And so he says, factual prophecy only tells us so much and no more. Beyond that, we must make certain assumptions. If these are correct, they will lead to valid conclusions. But if not, they may lead to ridiculous speculation. For example, it is an assumption that Russia will invade Israel in the last days. We know Gog will, and I strongly believe it's going to be Russia. But that the passage says Gog. You understand? And, you know, I've written endless articles about how I think it's going to be Russia and all of this, but that is an assumption. Do you follow? And there's some degree of possibility that I and you may be wrong on this. But this is the point he's making. And I'm just trying to make you become epistemologically self-conscious on this issue. Right? Everybody wants to be epistemologically self-conscious. and aware of what you and I are doing when we deal with a passage and move on, you know, and apply it. So, if these are correct, they will lead to valid conclusions, but if not, they may lead to ridiculous speculations. For example, it is assumed that Russia will invade Israel in the last days. Whether or not that is factual depends on the legitimacy of one's interpretation of Ezekiel's Magog prophecy in 38 and 39 of Ezekiel. And then he goes on and talks about, come on, speculations. Oh, it moved. I just didn't realize it. See, there you go. and a third thing is speculations. Now, I believe in speculating, but you have to speculate in a controlled manner within parameters. You see what I'm saying? This is basically my talk in a nutshell here. Is there's valid speculation, in my opinion, and invalid speculation. Now, some of y'all aren't going to agree with my parameters. I understand that. But I'm at least going to lay them out. And we will have a question-answer time in which you can come after me on that. But nevertheless, there are purely calculated guesses based on assumptions. In many cases, they have no basis in prophetic fact at all. For example, the Bible says the number of the Antichrist is 666. And I say that because the Greek text says 666. So it's not three sixes that equal 18, if you follow what I'm saying. It's 666 in Revelation 13:18. We must try to assume what that means. It is an assumption that is a literal number that will appear on things in the last days. And I believe, you know, as the text says, it'll be a mark. And that Greek word for mark means something like a brand or a tattoo. I can't imagine that happening today, can you? If you study that Greek word out, and some people are going to have tattoo removal in order to take theirs. So so we're gonna, you know, we're gonna have that. That's a speculation that there is going to be tattoo removal there. You see, but nevertheless, the time has come when serious students of biblical prophecy must be clear about what is fact, what is assumption, and what is speculation. So, I think the process is first of all dealing with the interpretation of a passage in its context. Because the Bible has laid out this framework, as I was trying to say at the beginning, of it, God's plan for Israel, and I believe there are clear categories that are laid out when things are going to happen. The 70th week of Daniel, as I've heard Chuck Missler say many years, quoting Dr. Walbert, that there's more passages talking about the seven-year tribulation than any other time period in the Bible, more than even Christ's first coming. And if that's true, notice that, if that's true, obviously, if it's not quite true, it's right on up there. But nevertheless, there's a lot dealing with the tribulation period. And so there's a lot of, you know, a person could write an 18 novel series or something like that. There's so much information. 18, was that the number, Tim? Was it 18, Tim? 16, excuse me. I got to get my numbers right here, see? And 16. Oh, 16. Yes. Thank you for that assist there, John. And so, as you interpret the passage in context, you need to be able to state this passage is referring to blah during relating to the tribulation period, relating to the second coming, relating to the millennial period, relating to the eternal state. You see, there's categories that through the progress of revelation that have been laid out clearly in Scripture. And so that produces facts or information. And you need to start there no matter what. Because we like to take passages and make them, I call them refrigerator verses, put them on the refrigerator, right? I mean, one that people like to use is, be still and know that I am God. And I've heard whole sermons on this, and they border on transcendental meditation and stuff like this. You know what I mean? Have you ever read the context? He's talking to his enemies. God's talking to his enemies, and they are rebelling against God, and God's basically saying, you folks need to calm down and think about who you're going up against. Be still and know that I'm God. Has nothing to do with transcendental meditation. But you can sell that passage pretty good if you make it a refrigerator verse, right? If you pull it out and stick it up on the refrigerator, be still and know that I am God. But if you, you know, I mean, there goes all those refrigerator verses if you read it in context. There's nothing wrong with putting a verse on the refrigerator. Just know what the context is. And so you can't support transcendental meditation or any of this so-called spiritual formation stuff that's popular nowadays with that passage. And so you have to start with interpretation, the right facts, what does it fit into, and then the assumptions that you make. Russia is a Gog, that's a title chapter from Hal Lindsey's Right Gate Planet Earth. I happen to agree with him, but that is an assumption, you see. I mean, a pretty safe bet that Persia's Iran, right? Pretty safe bet. But that is taking it a second step. You know, he's identifying that. The issues there in Gog and Magog, of course, are the timing of when it's going to be fulfilled, as most things are. And then you speculate in terms of it. Well, you know, I've been using the article, Russia and Iran had a military maneuver together like 3 or 4 years ago for the first time in their history. So they're coming together, right? And when Hal Lindsey in 1970 wrote Like a Planet Earth, Turkey was a friend of the United States and Israel. And Hal said in Like a Planet Earth that Turkey's going to be moving away from the West eventually. Well, that was a speculation. It just so happened it's right, isn't it? I mean, Turkey is in the news every day for some hatred against Israel now. And they used to be buds. They used to hang out and let Israel Air Force fly in Turkey and all of this kind of stuff, and even thought about shipping some water from Turkey into Israel and all this kind of stuff. But now the Islamists have taken over, and it's sure that speculation appears to be properly setting the stage. So we just need to make sure that when we're speculating, when we're making assumptions, and whether something is a biblical fact when we're dealing with this. People say we're living in the last days. You know, I'm head of Last Days Ministries and all of this. Are we in the last days? Well, it's not that simple. We are and we aren't, because there's multiple usages of the phrase last days, and I have them listed right here. In the Old Testament, you have latter days, like Deuteronomy 4:30 says, in the latter days, Israel's going to come around and accept the Lord. That's in Deuteronomy 4:30. And last days there, I think, refers to, as you go on, the tribulation period, you see, and the millennium and those kinds of, those, the, basically after the church age is over. And most of the terms latter days, last day, latter years do refer to the tribulation period relating to Israel. So are we in the last days in the way in which the Old Testament uses it? No, we're not. But then you come to the New Testament, and it talks about in the latter days. 1 Timothy 4:1 says, evil men and apostles will proceed from bad to worse. No, that's in 2 Timothy 3. But something, you know, it says men will fall away from the faith in 1 Timothy 4:1. Are we in the latter days of the church? Probably, yes. The last days there in 2 Timothy 3:1, probably. Hebrews 1:2, well, that began with the church age. There in Hebrews 1:2, it refers to the whole church age. Why? Because he's talking about the last phase in history before the events of leading up to the tribulation and the millennium are going to start happening. And this is the last period where men's going to have an opportunity to accept Christ, of course, other than the tribulation. In other words, there's an urgency to the church age, because it's the time in which people need to trust Christ as their Savior. And so it's these last days, you see. So it refers to the church age. So a lot of our critics, what do? They come in and go to Hebrews 1, and they say it refers to the whole church age, and they take that and try to apply it to all the usages, rather than doing what a good biblical exegete is supposed to do, and that is look at each individual passage in the context and see how it's used. And that's why I have these multiple uses listed here. And last days, last time, I think in the New Testament refers to the church age. And so, yes, we're in the last days when the apostasy is going to get worse and worse. And that's a qualitative event. In other words, no matter how bad it is today, it can get worse tomorrow. Believe it or not, isn't that wonderful? Cheer up. It's going to get worse before it gets worse. Those left-wingers over there, they think that's pretty good. But nevertheless. So, then you run into the whole issue of basic approaches to dealing with Bible prophecy. And you know that I've dealt with this for a good while over the years. And there are four ways, in addition to whether you're amill, premill, postmill. Okay. There are issues relating to when Bible prophecy is going to be related to right now. And there are four basic views, because there are four theoretical ways you can relate to time. right now. Past, present, future, and timeless or atemporal. And so, of course, someone down through church history has come up with saying that prophecy is going to be fulfilled in relation to all these four different ways. And the first is known as preterism. We bashed them a lot over the 23 years since we've been here, haven't we, Chuck? Yeah, we've worked preterist over. And the Greek word preterism means past or gone by. And they believe there's different kinds of preterism. There's extreme or full preterism, who believes that Bible prophecy was fulfilled in and around the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in AD 70. And that's it. And you thought it was bad to say we're in the millennium today, you know, amillennialism, postmillennialists who believe we're in the millennium today. And I always say, well, we're in the millennium, I'm on the ghetto side. And then you realize there is no ghetto in the millennium. But these guys go an extra mile. And they say we're in the new heavens and new earth. How many of y'all are married? Remember what Jesus said? They'll be neither married nor given in marriage, you know, in that time. And, you know, and even some of these full preterists are married, believe it or not. And, you know, so they believe we're in the new heavens and the new earth. My, what a disappointment if we're in the new heavens and new earth. And so when you look at a preterist site, check out to see if they're full preterists. They believe all prophecies already been fulfilled and they're living in La La Land or Disney World. I don't know. And then you have moderate preterists, which most people are moderate preterists, like R.C. Sproul, Hank Intergraff, and some of these others, even though Hank never would admit he's a preterist, but walks like, talks like, you know, quacks like. You know, if you I try to tell him, if you take preterist interpretations, doesn't that make you a preterist? Oh, well. And they believe that most of Bible prophecy was fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. You know, like Revelation 19, the second coming, Matthew 24, 29 through 31 was fulfilled in AD 70. Jesus came back through the Roman army, all of this kind of stuff. And they require the book of Revelation to have been written in AD 65, and our brother Mark Hitchcock has demonstrated in his dissertation and in the debate we have on our Preacher of website, you know, that it was AD 95. So that is the silver bullet against preterism, that how could it be a prophecy about the future if it was written in AD 95 about AD 70? Sorry, that dog won't hunt, even in Florida. And then there's mild preterism, which is the first kind of preterism ever. I've never met an actual mild preterist who believes that, and this was in the early 1600s, that part of the book of Revelation is about God defeating the Jews in AD 70, and the second half is about God defeating his other ancient enemy, the Roman Empire. That is how preterism began, and it developed from that way. And so you have to figure out, has the book of Revelation and these things been fulfilled yet? And the one prophecies we're talking about, no, they haven't. But you need to be aware of that when you're reading, you know, other people's views on this. And, you know, that's their idea. Relax, it all happened in AD 70. So you don't need to, as one preterist said, you don't need to lock your screen door because the Antichrist has already come. He was Nero. Well, what about all his disciples that are running around? You know, I think you'd still need to lock your screen door. But nevertheless, then the second kind is historicism, that teaches that prophecy is being fulfilled today in the church age. That the events of the book of Revelation, by the way, these terms were all coined in relation to the book of Revelation, but they're used in a more broad sense beyond that. And historicism is a view that was developed in the Middle Ages by Joachim de Fiori around 1100-1200s, where he believed that the events of today were being fulfilled, were fulfilling events in the book of Revelation, and that expanded, and Martin Luther picked it up and brought it into Protestantism. You know, Luther did not like the book of Revelation, but he translated it anyway because it was part of the historic canon when he did the German translation. And then a few years later, he found out you could make the Pope the Antichrist and that will preach. And he loved the book of Revelation from then on. And it became so widespread among Protestants that it was called the Protestant view, because of them fighting the Reformation when it came in and making the Pope the Antichrist. Do I hear an amen on that? Amen. Okay, good. And so, historicism believes the seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments are being fulfilled in the church age. And so they will go through and get different events. Well, the Pope's each successive pope is the Antichrist. You have what's called the day-year theory, that 1,260 days really means 1,260 years. Or the 2,300 days in the book of Daniel are really 2,300 years. But y'all didn't know that. See, so this is why everything but futurism, as we're going to show you, is a form of allegorical interpretation. What is allegorical interpretation? It's where you bring in an idea from outside the text that's not in the text, and you have to use that idea in order to come up with your conclusion or interpretation. And so that is a classic illustration, is that you replace Israel, the text says Israel, and you think church. That's allegorical interpretation. You've just brought in an idea that's not actually stated in the text, whereas literal interpretation is to take the text for what it actually says in its original context. So, if days mean days, then they're turning them into years. That's an allegorical interpretation. Okay. Then you have the seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments fulfilled during European events of the last 2,000 years. And they are champion date setters. We are pikers when it comes to date setting compared to these folks. And here's Albert Barnes' historical interpretation of Revelation 6 through 19. And by the way, historicists were amill, premill, and postmill. They were all, whether you're premill, postmill, or amill, they were all historicists. And so, you know, they come up with things like the first seal is the white horse conqueror, and that's a peace and triumph in the Roman Empire from Domitian to Commodus, 96 to 180. David Koresh was a historicist. About the only historicists left in America are the cults. And this stuff started going out in Britain in the early 1800s, as they started shifting toward futurism, and in after the Civil War in the United States, in this country. And so you see, Martin Luther could have been one of the first angelic announcement in Revelation 14. And someone said Joseph Wolfe was the second, because he was an evangelist in the 1800s to the Muslims and the Jews. See what I'm saying? They take historical events and they apply it to today. And so it leads up to like the French Revolution or something like that, when the Antichrist was dethroned. That is the Catholic Church. The French kicked them out. And then they're waiting for Armageddon. And that's why I lived in Austin when the first Gulf War took place, Austin, Texas. And they had a front page article by a Seventh-day Adventist minister on why the Gulf War could lead to Armageddon. Because we've gone through the seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments, and we're waiting for the last event, Armageddon. Whereas, had they interviewed me, which of course there's no reason for them to have done that, I would have said, no, it can't be Armageddon because we haven't had the rapture, we haven't had the seven-year tribulation, and Armageddon comes at the end. So we didn't believe that the Gulf War could lead to Armageddon and things. So these are most of the commentaries in the 1800s, if you read some of the older, and on the Olivet Discourse, they're all historicist. And so historicists take a preterist view of the Olivet Discourse. And historicism on the Olivet Discourse taught that their verses 4 through 12 were being fulfilled during the church age, what's called the Inter Advent Age. So that the wars and rumors of wars and stuff could refer to the events that are taking place today. And you can see where I'm leading to if you know me. And that is that I don't believe the Olivet Discourse refers to the Inter Advent Age, that it refers to the tribulation. And therefore, verses 4 through 9 or verses 4 through 12, in my opinion, do not refer to what's happening today. They parallel the seal judgments of the book of Revelation, as I'll show you in a minute. And so, that's historicism, and what I'm saying is, if you're running around today saying that prophecy is being fulfilled today, logically, those are historicist statements. Now, you may say, well, I don't put myself into a straitjacket of these abstract categories and things like this, but nevertheless, from a historical perspective, if you're saying prophecy is being fulfilled today, then you, like, for example, Hal Lindsey, are a futurist primarily, but you have elements of historicism in you at certain points. Now, why does that concern me? Because I'm director of the Pre-Trib Research Center, and that undermines imminency in pre-tribulationalism, you see. Or maybe you think Babylon, it refers to Rome. Guess what? That's a classic historicist view. I am so strange. I believe Babylon actually means Babylon. And that's a futurist view. But you read all of these older books, and they have historicist perspectives, and people pick up on that. And that's a hangover. And I think it took time as we shifted over in the 1800s from historicism to futurism to come up with a consistent futurist approach to these issues. Now, futurism is the view we hold. Let's hear a cheer.
Yay!
Thank you, John. Yes. And futurism is what most of the early church held, although they were inconsistent. And this is what, you know, they believe in a literal antichrist, that he's an actual person. 7 years means 7 years. 1,260 days means 1,260 days. In other words, we believe in the literal interpretation of these events. The symbols represent actual historical events, like symbols always do in the Bible, etc. And so futurism leads to the chart that I have there with the 70th week of Daniel, the second coming, and a literal thousand-year millennial kingdom of Christ. And so then idealism is the belief that the book of Revelation does not deal with the timing of issues in relation to prophecy, and they're just ideas. Like, we win. And a lot of young people today, that's all they'll say about the book of Revelation today is, we win. Well, yeah, I know we're going to win, but there's a few details sewn in there, you know, about how it's going to happen. And so when you come to prophetic timing and millennial views, preterism, you can be amill, postmill, but not premill and be a preterist. Okay. You can be historicist, you can be all three, amill, premill, postmill. See, you thought it was complicated just with amill, premill. And then you throw in these other combinations, right? makes your head spin. In futurism, you cannot, who was that Dutch guy? No, Prime Minister. Kuiper claimed to be a futurist Amil. But basically, you can't be a futurist and be an Amil. But you can be a futurist post-mill, although I don't know of any today. Some guy wrote a book somewhere north of South Carolina, I forget. But almost all futurists today are pre-mills. An idealist, Amil, yes. Post-mill, yes. Pre-mill, no. In fact, which one of these views do you think is dominating evangelical scholarship today? Right, Andy's right. Number four, idealism is taking over. And we are being called bigots and dogmatic because we think we know what's going to happen in the future. And they try to say that we're a bunch of dogmatic people, and they're so humble. And even though they have 15 PhDs, in every known academic field, they don't know anything. And things and stuff like that. So then when you come to the tribulation timing issue, okay, obviously you have to be a pre-mill to be anything other than a post-trib. Does that make sense? See, if you're post-mill and amill, then you have to be post-trib. There's a single future coming. So, preterist cannot be pre, mid, or post-mill trib in the sense of a futurist. They only believe in a single coming. Historicist, you cannot be pre-trib, but you could be mid or post-trib because we're in the tribulation, starting in the early church, see, with historicism. Now, some forms of historicism, who's that guy out of Indiana on the radio? He believes the first 3.5 years were historicist. No. Irwin Baxter, thank you. And he believes like this, that the first 3.5 years were a historicist throughout the church age, but the last 3.5 years are going to be literal. So he's a blend of those two things. And he's post-trib. So he believes that each successive pope was an antichrist, but also he believes in a personal antichrist. So, then you have futurism. You can be pre, mid, post, or quarter rapture, three-quarter rapture, partial rapture, and all that. And then idealism, there's no separate rapture event. So these are the combinations here that work itself out. And so in Matthew 24, Jesus said, but all these were merely the beginning of birth pains, referring to the first verse, all that discourse starts in verse 4, and it runs to 35, on Christ talking about what I think is the tribulation. So he's talking about, in my opinion, the 7-year tribulation, so it doesn't matter how long a generation is, because it's only going to last 7 years. And I think he's referring to the generation that sees the events of the tribulation will not pass away until these are fulfilled, because he speaks about if Christ didn't interrupt that 7-year period at the end of the 7 years, then all flesh would be destroyed. So that generation won't pass away until these are fulfilled. So the birth pangs is a term that's used in the Old Testament for the tribulation period. And we see it in Jeremiah 30, verses 6 through 7. He says, ask now and see if a male can give birth. Well, I guess they didn't see the movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it, I never saw it either, but I saw the previews. So, why do I see every man with his hands on his loins as a woman in childbirth. Alas, for that day is great. There is none like it. It is the time of Jacob's distress or trouble, but he will be saved from it. This is talking about Israel, the tribulation. It's the time of Jacob's trouble, and he compares them to the birth pangs of a woman giving birth. And that's referring to the tribulation period, the time of Jacob's trouble or distress. And you see it in Isaiah as well, in chapter 13, verses 6 through 9. And he says, well, for the day of the Lord is near. And that's the most frequently used term to describe the 70th week of Daniel, the day of the Lord. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. Therefore, all hands will fall limp and every man's heart will melt and they will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take hold of them and they will look at one another in astonishment. Their faces aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming. The tribulation period, it's coming. And so, I think when he refers to birth pangs, he's referring to the 70th week of Daniel. And you see in 1 Thessalonians 2, 5, 2 through 3, Paul, I think, also refers to the tribulation period as birth pangs. He says, for you yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord, the tribulation, will come just as a thief in the night. See, it won't come as a thief for us, but for unbelievers. And that's always where this thief in the night idea is related to. It's the unbeliever is never going to be prepared. And he's always going to be caught off guard. Whereas a believer, there's nothing special that you do to prepare for the Lord's coming because you've done it by becoming a believer. And you're going to be taken at the rapture. So there's no special alert. We're simply supposed to be alert. Because in the night, which is the church age in this context, and serving the Lord, while they are saying, they, unbelievers, saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them suddenly like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. And so what I'm saying is, if you look in Revelation 6, where all of us here, most likely, there may be an odd one or two here in the crowd, I don't know. But most of us believe that Revelation 6 is the beginning of the tribulation, with the rider on the white horse being the Antichrist with his false program coming on the scene. And when you look at Matthew 24, Mark 13, and Luke 21, the parallel references to the Olivet Discourse, you have Christ's statement in the same exact word order as the first five seal judgments that take place. And I think this makes better sense to go from the clear passage in Revelation to the less clear. And also it makes sense that what you have is Christ giving his sermon on the tribulation leading up to the second coming, which does not include the rapture because it's not revealed until a few days later. And therefore, earthquakes and famines and wars and these things do not refer to our own day as many of us, including myself at one time, have believed. Because these are referring to the world wars and earthquakes and famines that are specifically mentioned at the beginning of the tribulation. And that's why Christ in the Olivet Discourse says these are the beginning of tribulation. So, I remember being at a conference with Hal Lindsey out in California, and he gave a whole hour lecture on earthquake statistics. And because he believes, like John Walvoord did, and many other real good people in our camp, that these refer to the inter-advent age and the first part of the Olivet Discourse. And therefore, with birth pangs, it means they're going to get worse and worse and worse. And people have written all kinds of articles debating whether earthquakes are. And then Hal says, well, it's major earthquakes, killer quakes. And so they get in an argument over that. And my point is that no one doubts when you're having global earthquakes in the tribulation, that relates to that, and it's in the same exact order. And the question in the Olivet Discourse is, what are the signs that are going to lead up to your coming? And so I think it's best to take these as events relating to the tribulation. Therefore, we do not have prophecy being fulfilled today. Well, what about Israel? Yes, Israel's in the process of being regathered. But it's a process that started and is still going on. And it will not be completed until after the rapture when the tribulation starts. So I believe that there are transition periods. We also see in Deuteronomy 32:20, and I believe Israel is a sign of the time. I believe there are signs of the times, as I'll show you in a minute. So don't stone me yet. In Deuteronomy 32:20, you have the Lord saying that He will, that when Israel goes into the dispersion, He will hide His face from them. And He will not listen to their prayers. And you see in Isaiah 1:15 similar language about hiding His face. And this is the introduction of the lawsuit that Isaiah brings the reeve against the nation of Israel. And he talks in Isaiah 59:2 also about hiding His face from the nation of Israel. And these appear to be related to their, what we later learn is the rejection of the Messiah, their disobedience. And then when you get to Ezekiel chapter 39, he talks about how in relation to Gog and Magog and the events that he's been prophesying, how he will set his face toward them again in the last days. And I bring that up because I think that all of these feast days and all of this kind of stuff, everybody wants the rapture to happen on Rosh Hashanah and all this kind of stuff. Well, I'm sorry, those relate to Israel. And He suspended His dealings with Israel during the church age. The church age is a timeless event. And you can figure out how many moons and all of this kind of stuff you want all day long, and they don't relate to the church age. Now, it's very likely that once the rapture occurs and the 70th week of Daniel starts, that this stuff is going to become relevant again. Rosh Hashanah is going to be fulfilled at the second coming, Matthew 24:31, when He sends His angels to collect the Jewish people and bring them back to Israel. All the prophecies relating to the feast relate specifically to Israel, not to the church. And you can say I'm a hyper-dispensationalist and all that's fine. I'm actually a traditional dispensationalist. Hyper-dispensationalism is if you believe that that there's a Jewish church and a Gentile church. I don't. But I'm saying, I'm applying, these things and just throwing them out there. Dr. Walbert said in Oil, Middle East Crisis, etc., that there are no signs for the rapture itself, but what are the legitimate grounds for believing that the rapture could be especially near in this generation? And I believe that. The answer is not found in any prophetic events predicted before the rapture, but in understanding the events that will follow the rapture. Just as history was prepared for Christ's first coming, in a similar way, history is preparing for the events leading up to the second coming. If this is the case, it leads to the inevitable conclusion that the rapture may be exceedingly near. And so we see a transition period where God fulfilled the destruction of Jerusalem and various things relating to Israel as He transitioned in the book of Acts from Israel to the church. Even though the church began in Acts 2 on the day of Pentecost, there was still a transition period. And so he's arguing, and I agree, that there could be a transition period at the end of the church age in preparation for the events leading up to the 70th week of Daniel and Israel. And so what we have today in relation to fulfillment of prophecy is we're having preparation for fulfillment of prophecy, not actual fulfillment yet. And I think it's an overstatement to say that prophecy is being fulfilled today, other than the general trends of the church age being a time where the gospel is going to spread and the church, as it gets bigger, will become increasingly apostate. That's basically the trends of the church age. And we're to be constantly waiting for Christ's return. And so the rapture ends the church age, as we all know. But there is an interval of days, weeks, months, or years, probably years, where you're going to have further preparation. I mean, you have this in 2 Thessalonians 2, that the restrainer is holding back the church. I mean, holding back the Antichrist. And once he's gone, then the Antichrist can come on the scene. And then you read the book of Daniel, the details. You have the little horn, the Antichrist, arising from the 10 nations. So that takes time for them to get into position. They're being restrained up during the church age, you see, so they can't come on the scene then. And after the rapture, it's going to take time for these events to occur, for the 10-nation confederacy to develop, revive Roman Empire. Then you have the rise of the Antichrist, and then he becomes the Antichrist and takes over and makes the covenant with Israel that starts the 7th. So there's got to be a preparation time. And so I think Gog and Magog could take place during this interval after the rapture. But Gog and Magog, based on this last part of 39, has to be related to the tribulation in some way, you see. And so then you have the start of the tribulation and the fulfillment of hundreds of specific prophecies during this time. And that's when they're actually going to be fulfilled. And so I think we can say that we're seeing the stage being set for, here comes Jesus. There he comes. See anybody you know? Okay. So I believe the stage is being set today for these events like never before. You have preparation for the mark of the beast. Israel's back in the land, ready as a nation where these events could be fulfilled. It seems to be getting more and more tenuous every day, but nevertheless, that could be setting the stage for the EU coming in, or the revived Roman Empire, to make an agreement to protect Israel. And you have Russia in preparation, Iran and those folks, efforts to rebuild the temple, as Price is going to talk about. Babylon, I think, is going to be restored. And globalism, no matter what the problem is today, for the last 100 years, globalism seems to be the solution for everybody. And both economically, politically, socially, everything. And Jerusalem is back under Israel's control to some extent, not fully. And you have the reconstitution of Israel's ancient enemies in the Middle East. And so the stage is being set. But we don't know how set it's going to be. And so that's why you can't date the rapture. I asked you out for a date once, wouldn't go. But nevertheless, you can't date the rapture. And so you have, and no matter how ready things appear to be, they can always be more ready. And so that's why I'm saying we need to work, I think, within this framework that I've laid out here, the European Union as well. And I am now ready for questions. Andy.
Okay.
Tom, I first of all want to say thank you for your presentation. I think it helps represent that we're all here with humble attitudes, wanting to fine-tune what we believe. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about this conference, is that we're all trying to be iron sharpening iron, and we're teachable. And he didn't pay me to say this, but I think your presentation shows that God has raised you up for such a time as this, because it's so important. What you're saying is really, really important. My question is, what does the idea of fulfillment of prophecy, or the mountain peaks of prophecy that are seen as being fulfilled in multiple ways, how does that play into your understanding?
It doesn't.
So that's what I thought, but a lot of people would argue that there's some very clear reasons to believe that some prophecies may be fulfilled in more than one time period.
Right. Yeah, and that's a view that began, according to Ed Heinzen's master's study research at Trinity, began with liberals in the 1800s with the Isaiah 7:14 passage. I believe that you can have a passage where part of the passage is fulfilled at Christ's first coming, and then comma or period, the other part is fulfilled at his second coming, for example, when he got up and read the scroll and said, "Today this is fulfilled in your sight." But you cannot have the same passage fulfilled multiple times. Unless it's like in Deuteronomy where it's talking about cycles of discipline and things like this, you know, where he's saying that there's going to be multiple events in Israel's history. But specific prophecy like Isaiah 7:14 or others, prophecy becomes meaningless if it can have multiple fulfillments. In my opinion, I think there's only a single fulfillment of any specific prophecy. Now there are types, patterns that are developed, but that's not a prophecy in and of itself in the way, you know, Christ will be born in Bethlehem, you know, type prophecy. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
Tommy, thanks for your message. I think I know the answer to these few questions already, I want you to clarify a few points, because I know you last year, you know, along the same lines of today's message, you know, you kind of took the harbinger to task and poked fun there. And some of us just, you know, think that's an incredible prophetic word to America right now. And first question, when there's just so many coincidences, I mean, I was taught coincidence is not a kosher word. You know, when you see all these coincidences line up, you have to just make them a bunch of coincidences unless you can see the sovereign hand of God in it. So answer that regarding the harbinger first.
Yeah, well, the harbinger is based on what? Isaiah 9?
9:10.
9:10. And Khan admits it's fulfilled for Israel earlier.
Sure.
And then he comes and applies it to America.
Okay.
And so that would either be a double fulfillment, which is wrong, or secondly, he's basing it on his extra biblical revelation or insight, which I don't trust.
Fair enough. Have you seen it? Have you watched it?
Yeah, I've read the book.
It's just a bunch of coincidences, in your opinion.
Well, others have written more detailed analysis. I rejected it textually, and I didn't care about these other events, you see, because that's not important if it's rejected at the biblical level, you see.
So the whole premise, I mean, there's just too many coincidences, you wouldn't even go there.
Well, others have shown that he's off on a lot of his numbers and stuff, and that there some of his stuff is wrong. And I would have to refer you to those.
Okay, I've read some of that.
Yeah.
Okay, connected to that, there's some dear friends of this group right here, John McTernan and Bill Koenig, and the work that they've done in terms of eye to eye and in terms of as America's done to Israel. They've done research since George Bush won. Surely you're familiar with that. Now,
yes.
Is that all just a bunch of coincidences too?
Well,
or is there a prophetic connection between Israel and America?
Depends on what you mean by prophetic. Are you talking extra biblical revelation, or are you talking about
interpretation? Okay.
I don't know that Bill claims that this is absolutely true. He's suggesting it. As long as he's suggesting that this is saying, that's fine to look at it. Actually, I would be more interested in knowing about Israel's weather, because in the Old Testament, Israel was the nation that was promised God controlling the weather or bringing in bad weather in relation to them. And it seems to think that America is somehow a new Israel. And that was one of my criticisms of Khan.
Doesn't believe that, but that's okay.
Well, he says that in the book. He says he doesn't believe it, but he stated it in the book, at least in my edition of the book, which was an early edition. Maybe he's changed it since then. But that logically, and I know he's not replacement theology at all, but that is the logic of replacement theology, to say that America is some kind of new Israel.
Yeah, which is wrong, and we don't believe that.
Yeah. So I don't know where America has some specialness about it that God would uniquely judge it. And I've asked Bill about, what about Europe? You know, other nations have historically treated Israel worse than us. And, you know, how's their weather?
Okay. So, just to clarify, the same coincidences of Isaiah 9, 10, the harbinger, basically no room in your theology.
No,
the same...
I would say that, there may be something to that, but you can't say based on biblical authority that that's true.
No, okay.
It just may be an observation of history, and I'm open to that.
Okay, fair enough. The same thing's true of the eye to eye, because, I mean, it's not just weather patterns. Sometimes it's stock market crashes.
Right.
Sometimes it's, you know, fires and the, I mean, it's just, again, you have to say that there are hundreds and hundreds of coincidences, and just ignore them as coincidences, or there's something there.
Yeah, there may be something there, but it's not based on any biblical interpretation or anything.
Okay, now final question. From a Hebraic perspective, interpretation, there's four levels. There's the primary level, which is the simple understanding. Then there's the second level, third level. Then there's a fourth level of interpretation from a Hebraic perspective. I'm sure you're familiar with it. It's sod. It's called the mythical, or we would say even prophetic level. You have no room for that at all, or do you?
No room at all, because the Jews picked it up from the Babylonians.
To answer this question, God controls the weather in Israel, how the Lord.
Oh, okay, thank you. Yeah, real quick.
Yeah, well, I think we have time for one
more. Okay, real quick, last question.
Last question. Is the mic on?
Mic on, yes.
Ezekiel dry bones vision, how is that not fulfilled?
Because it's a process still going on. I take it as a process. It's in the process of going on. I would see that as transitional. And I agree with David L. Cooper and Arnold Fruchtenbaum's that there's two regatherings of Israel, before the tribulation and after the tribulation. A nation born in a day, for example, relates to Israel at the second coming in the context. You see, and a lot of those passages that speak of Israel's regathering refer to the future regathering in belief, whereas a few passages talk about Israel being regathered in preparation for the tribulation. And so that process is still going on, but I think it's a sign of the times, if you will. In other words, why would God regather Israel if he's not going to do anything? Because he says that, and I disagree with a lot of people who say that Israel could be regathered, kicked out of the land, regathered, kicked out of the land, and all that. No, no, no. It talks about a regathering from the nations, a regathering, you know, and that's what's happening now. It's the first regathering from the nations.